Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, everybody, whatever time it is where you are. Thanks for being here. Nice to see everybody online too, and a bunch of us here in the room. Well, I listened to the recording of last week's seminar, and it sounds like everybody had a really great time. And Jean did a super job of bringing up the sutra, and Roberta, Pearl, Nick, and Neil did a great job reading the sutra. And I thought it was a really brilliant exercise of writing down some phrase that struck you as you were listening. And I think that we should continue that practice throughout the time we're reading the sutra. That tonight, when I quote passages, you can get out something to write with and write down a word or phrase. Because that's the way it is with sutras. A lot of it doesn't really matter to you, but one thing matters, and you maybe never forget it. So it's worth it to look for those things. And sometimes it's unexpected. Why is this important to me? I don't even know. And if you write it down, then for sure you'll remember it. So I think that where I left off, we had not yet gotten to Sudana's pilgrimage yet. But Jean and everyone else plunged us right into the pilgrimage, and I'll continue with it. Before I do that, I want to bring up a few points. Maybe I brought them up before, you know, I don't remember anymore where I said what, when. So, but it's all the same anyway, so. But forgive me if I've already said this in this seminar. The question of bodhisattva compassion, for sure we've referred to this. And early on in the sutra, the idea of the compassion of the bodhisattva as a motivating force, almost like an energy, has been mentioned. And the thing about compassion is that it is never ending. So the pilgrimage of a bodhisattva, an enlightening being, is an endless pilgrimage because the bodhisattva is always on her way to awakening but never arrives, or at least doesn't arrive, until all sentient beings are also awakened. So that means that the journey goes on and on. And so this is, you know, one of the really essential points about bodhisattvas. They are endlessly enthusiastic, endlessly energetic, and endlessly compassionate, and these three things always go together. Now, we all know this, but it's worth repeating that bodhisattvas are imaginary beings. They're always perfect and young and good-looking and energetic, always, because they're imaginary beings. They're not like us. We're not like them, and we're never going to be like them. So we shouldn't be comparing ourselves to them and thinking, wow, you know, I'm not doing as well as they are. That makes no sense. We shouldn't even think of them as ideals that we aspire to, because we are not imaginary in the same way that they are. We're imaginary beings in a very different way. But because both they and we are imaginary beings, in a way, we are like them already, exactly. And our activity that we measure objectively and in our own scale is actually the activity of bodhisattvas as described in this sutra, even though we don't look at it that way. But the question of compassion. Why are bodhisattvas always so compassionate? Why should compassion be so important on this spiritual journey? And it reminds me of a story that I've probably told you before, but long, long time ago, when Kathy and I were taking a seminary with Professor Lewis Lancaster, the great Professor Lancaster at UC Berkeley, we were reading in the seminar the Diamond Sutra in Chinese, which is to say, Professor Lancaster was reading the Diamond Sutra in Chinese, and we had in front of us a Chinese text, and we were trying to follow along with what he was reading. And as you know, the Diamond Sutra is a Prajnaparamita text, which is a text that is all about the wisdom of the emptiness of all things. It emphasizes the emptiness of all things. And the emptiness of all things means the boundlessness of all things, the non-separability of all things, the non-existence of anything as an entity, the dreamlike nature of things. That's the Prajnaparamita teachings of the Diamond Sutra. And I remember really well that at one point, maybe after class, we were talking, and Professor Lancaster said that he was an expert, you know, on Prajnaparamita and Chinese Buddhism. And I remember him saying that he could not understand why seeing the empty nature of things, as bodhisattvas do, would lead them to be compassionate. Why would that even be compatible with compassion? Since it seems so abstract, you know, all things are empty and all that, seems so abstract and abstruse, how could that possibly be compatible with compassion? It almost seems like the opposite of what compassion is. And he was genuinely, you know, this was his life's work, right? He genuinely was confused about this. And that question of his really, really struck me. And I think a lot of people have that same question when they encounter the emptiness teachings. So that goes to show you that bodhisattva compassion is radically different from compassion as we usually conceive of it. Because, think about it, compassion as we know it completely involves separation and boundaries. That's what compassion is all about, right? You're over there in need. I'm over here. I feel sympathetic to your need. I will help you. I feel compassion for you. I feel compassion for you. Usually, we feel compassion for some people, not everyone, some class or group of people, not everyone. I mean, why would we bother to feel compassion for privileged, important people who are powerful, especially if they're mean-spirited? And even more, what if they have hurt us or people that we know and like? We're going to feel compassion for them? Probably we're not. But bodhisattvas enter the realm of reality. Remember, that's the name of the text we're reading, Entry into the Realm of Reality. So bodhisattvas enter the realm of reality in which the immense imaginative flow of reality, the flow evoked by the outrageous and extravagant language of the sutra, that flow is so vast and so thorough that it is identical with compassion. Identical with love. So it's not that bodhisattvas have a feeling of compassion for some people that they feel sorry for or would like to help, maybe not others. Or they have a feeling that sometimes they feel and sometimes they don't feel. For bodhisattvas, there is no difference at all between truth, reality, awakening, compassion, and love. These are all just words to describe one thing. To appreciate things as they truly are in their most thorough and imaginative aspect is to enter into an ocean of love. Because reality itself is love. And this is perfectly obvious to bodhisattvas. And so, for them, the only possible way to practice the way of the Buddha is to practice with a loving heart for and with others. There would be no way that a person could practice by themselves and without reference to others. It would be impossible. It would be a total misconstrual of reality. And anyway, for bodhisattvas who love everyone, there actually is no everyone. There are no others. There's only compassion. And there's no other way that you could possibly live. So I don't think Jean covered the very beginning of the pilgrimage, but it turns out that it's Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, who sends Sudana on his pilgrimage. Now, this is also an important thing to think about, one of the foundations of this sutra and of all Mahayana sutras, the whole archetype of the Mahayana Buddhism has this element in it. That is, how important it is for bodhisattvas to serve Buddhas and listen to Buddhas and study with Buddhas. Everybody knows the classical story of the Buddha, who does study with some teachers, two or three, but quickly masters everything they have to teach and then goes forth on his own and awakens on his own. This is more or less reflected in the Mahayana Sutras, in which, and this is maybe a generalization, but it's more or less true, that in Mahayana Sutras, the Buddhas have power and the most powerfully transcendent wisdom, but they are the foundations for the way. They are the pillars of the way. They don't exactly interact or communicate with others. Usually they just sit there. And they empower the bodhisattvas to do the interaction and the teaching and the congress with others. Because bodhisattvas are, by their nature, always active. They're interactive, always. They're always practicing with spiritual friends, with their teachers, who awaken them. And that's their essence, that they always practice with others. And that practice with others, as we said, doesn't end. It goes on and on. Jean pointed out the very important point that every one of the people Sudana visits, everyone has a vast store of wisdom and practice, but not a single one of them thinks they have the last word. The form of the visits, everyone is, they say what they have, and then they end up saying, yes, I may know this, but I know nothing about so-and-so. Go to visit so-and-so, and that person knows that. So there's no end to the story, no matter how profound the teaching. There's more. This is what Manjushri says to Sudana at the outset of Sudana's pilgrimage. It is good that you follow spiritual benefactors, having set your mind on supreme enlightenment, that you think you should inquire into the practice of enlightening beings, wishing to fulfill the practice of enlightening beings. Attending and serving spiritual friends is the beginning, the logical course for the accomplishment of omniscience. Therefore, you should tirelessly attend spiritual benefactors. And with that, Sudana goes forth. Yeah, and again, Jean spoke wonderfully about the importance of our teachers, of our spiritual benefactors, how much they touch our hearts. There is no solitary achievement. There's only practicing and realizing together. Now, if you wanted to be cynical about it, you could say that the great sages who channeled this and other Mahayana sutras would say that, right? They would say that. this is a teaching that teachers would really appreciate, right? You should honor your teachers. You should always give them offerings. You should pay attention to them. You can't do it without them. You really, really need them. Teachers are very important. You can't do without them. Teachers would like to hear that, right? But when you think about the whole of the sutra and what it's saying, it sort of blows that point of view, that limited way of understanding what's being said here, out of the water. Every one of the teachers that Sudana encounters is different from every other one. There are all kinds of teachers, the monastics, experts on language, as Pearl read last week, healers, some of them are men, young men, old men, some of them are women, girls, old women. They're not necessarily anything like a conventional Buddhist teacher, although sometimes they could be a conventional Buddhist teacher, but more or less they're not. And this is telling us that reality is the teacher, that all beings are the teacher. In an imaginative and fully flowing reality, everything is the teacher and everything is the disciple. If a teacher happens to appear as a conventional Buddhist teacher, that is no different from any other appearances. Appearances are just appearances. And the appearances that characterize reality are infinite in nature. So this is really, if you reflect on it, a very, very beautiful thing. That we could have a beautiful spiritual relationship with a benefactor who looks out for our long-term and short-term interests, that somebody could touch our hearts in that way. That is really one of the most wonderful and unusual possibilities in a human lifetime. And in the world we live in, it is all but unknown. People don't even know such a thing exists. But to think that this is a possibility for human beings, and not only that, but that it's a possibility with every instance of reality that arises. This is a great thing. This is wonderful. Everybody knows, we all know, and we have in our own lives, relationships that are built on bonds of attachment and affection. And these relationships, as we know, can be very, very beautiful and wonderful, and we couldn't do without them. They're also sometimes painful, as we know, because they can't last forever. It can be very painful. But the relationships of teachers and disciples, of spiritual friends and spiritual benefactors, which are not founded on the bonds of attachment and affection, but on dharma, on non-attachment, non-separation, and unbounded love. This is the essence of the bodhisattva path. And that's why bodhisattvas are always serving Buddhas, infinite numbers of Buddhas. To be able to see in anyone and everyone a wise and perfect being, a being that we can really learn from, a person whose feet we can sit at. And this includes not only fellow human beings, but any kind of a being. A rock, a tree, a table, the ocean, the sky. To receive these teachings from these perfect beings is a fabulous thing. We look at people and we see a lot of faults in them, as we see in ourselves. Because that's the definition of being a person, isn't it? To have faults. That's what it means to be a person. And that's what we see when we look at one another and ourselves and at the world. But also, to be a human being, as we learn from our sutras, is to be a Buddha, which means that it is possible at the same time that we look at a person with their faults, also at the same time to look at that same person, including ourselves, and see their enormous and perfect beauty, and to see their wisdom, the wisdom that comes out of their unique lived experience, and to seek them out as teachers, to learn from them and grow through our interactions with them. That's the kind of world that this sutra proposes, a world full of teachers, full of Buddhas. Bodhisattvas know that reality itself is an interaction, a flow, a movement. Reality itself is constantly growing and changing and developing. And this is why they love all beings and constantly seek out spiritual teachers, not because they want to learn something they desperately need to know that's going to be of some use to them, but because they want nothing more than to go on and on, always starting from the beginning, to practice the Bodhisattva way, the way of reality. And when they practice with spiritual benefactors like this, it arises in them the feelings, the most precious of human feelings, love, devotion, total trust, respect, faith. When we have those feelings, we're happy people. It's a happy thing to feel those things. And it's sad that it's so hard to locate such feelings in the world we live in now. That is really one of the saddest things, you know, about our world, that we have lost track to such an extent of these kinds of precious human feelings. So I think by now it's pretty clear the pattern of these visits to the spiritual teachers. Sudana shows up to see the teacher, and while he's traveling, he's going over in his mind what he learned from the last teacher and how great it was. And then he finds the new benefactor, and that person's situation and life is briefly described. And then that benefactor elucidates their miraculous and vast practice, always ending, as I said, with saying, "But I might know that, but that's nothing. There's much more. Go over here, and this person over there will tell you about that," and sends Sudana on to the next benefactor. And you know, that's, when you think about it, you know, in old Tang and Song Dynasty Zen, didn't they kind of practice like that? They went from monastery to monastery seeking spiritual benefactors. They went all over the place. Their traveling was a big part of their, that's why straw sandals is a sort of symbol for the monastic, the sandals of traveling and the traveling pack. That's what they did. Just like Sudana, from teacher to teacher. In our day, we value established community and relationship with a teacher or teachers in that community. But that's just a kind of foundation, because we're also on pilgrimage. We're also meant to learn from all kinds of beings. All beings are our teachers everywhere. To be alive in this vast and imaginative human realm is to be always en route, always learning, always developing, right up until the end, if there is an end. And in the ordination ceremonies, we say, there's a line that we say, "From now on, Buddha is your teacher, and all beings are your teachers." We say that line. That was true before the ordination ceremony, but after the ceremony, you really know it's true, and you begin to live it. After that, the world is not the same world anymore, and people are not the same people anymore. So now I'll read some passages, and again, reminding you to write down anything that strikes you. So I'm going to read a little bit from, and I'm not going to read every word, but Saradvaja, that appears on page 73 of Cleary's version. So Sudhana encounters Saradvaja by the side of a place for walking at a retreat. And Saradvaja is sitting in profound concentration, following his breath, not moving, not thinking, his body straight, his mindfulness on the immediate present, by the inconceivable power of concentration producing to the left, right, and above an inconceivable infinite body in each successive mental moment, manifesting an infinite variety of bodies. That's what he was doing when Sudhana first encountered him. And that's supposed to be a description of what's going on when we're doing Zazen. That's what it is. So you can look that up if you want a good description of what's happening when we're doing Zazen, which we usually don't notice, of course, but that is what Dogen thinks is going on when we sit in Zazen. Once in a while, you do quiet your mind, right? I hope so, once in a while. And it's very, very peaceful. And even though you don't have such words and such images in your mind, it is kind of like that. There is an inconceivable body manifesting a great variety of bodies. Because when you sit in Zazen, you are no longer limited by your conditioned, temporary little self. Even if the content that self produces is what mostly occupies your mind. In the spaces between all that content, this is what you are. Because, as we all know, a human being is an immensely, immensely valuable and sacred thing, right? A human being is not just a piece of garbage you can pick up and throw away after you use it. We don't treat each other like that. We don't think of each other like that. A human being is an immense, measureless, great thing. And when we sit in Zazen, we sit in the middle of that immensity that we are. And Dogen often talks about practice with the body, the whole body, he says. I think in Fukan Zazengi, the whole body is far beyond the world's dusts. And it's a very big point, maybe the defining point in Buddha Dharma, what distinguishes Buddha Dharma from other sorts of religious ideas, is that there is not a mental world and a physical world. There is not an imaginative world and an objective world. There's one world. That one world, of course, can be seen and experienced in many, many ways, but it's only one world. So the body, the breath, the posture, the shoulders, the knees, the forehead, the ears, the shins, the feet, and so on, matter. Our bodies really matter. And so in the next passage, we hear about Saradvaja's body as he sits in meditation while Sudhana is standing next to him watching all this happen. So I'm not going to read all of it, but I'll give you a kind of a summary of it. Sudhana saw emanating from the soles of Saradvaja's feet masses of very impressive people, as numerous as atoms in countless Buddha lands, and so on and so on and so on, many things about this. From his knees, from Saradvaja's knees, Sudhana saw emerging forms of warrior sages, priestly sages, worldly sages, scholars versed in various crafts, humanistic scholars, scholars expert in knowledge of the sciences of mundane and transmundane activities, the entire staff of UC Hospital coming out of coming out of Sarvajna's knees, etc., etc. Out of his navel appeared various forms of wizards. Wizards, as many as there are living beings, and going throughout the 10 directions. And they were wearing leather, rags, and bark, because they're like shamans, you know, carrying staffs and pitchers, their deportment extremely calm, up to the sky extolling the qualities of Buddhas, and so on and so on and so on. From his sides emerged water spirit girls, as many water spirit girls as all worldly events in inconceivably many forms, pervading all universes moment to moment, showing the miracle of water spirits, adorning the sky with inconceivable fragrant clouds, beautiful clouds. And it goes on quite a while describing all of that. From Sarvajna's chest emerged as many titan kings as atoms in countless Buddha fields emerged from his chest and pervaded the cosmos moment to moment, displaying the inconceivable magic transformations of titans, etc., 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 and on and on. From his spine, spine is really important, right, in meditation, from his spine, Sudana saw, out of Sarvajna's spine, as many bodies of Buddhist disciples and individual illuminates, Pratyeka Buddhas, as atoms in countless Buddha fields emerged from his spine. They pervaded the cosmos, telling sentient beings attached to self and suited to guidance by disciples or individual illuminates about selflessness and the voidness of the being, clarifying the impermanence of all conditioned states to those attached to eternity, telling the lustful about the contemplation of impurity, telling the hostile about love, telling the deluded about causality and interdependent origination, illuminating principles connected with the sphere of knowledge to those who are equally lustful, hostile, and deluded, telling those attached to objects about non-dwelling, causing those inclined to stick to tranquility, to like the superiority of undertaking vows, showing actions beneficial to beings in all places, in the beginning of all turnings of the oceans of ways of truth. From the shoulders came demigods and supernatural beings, as many as atoms and so on. From the abdomen, centaur chiefs, as many of them as atoms in countless Buddha fields and so on and so on. From the face, emperors and rulers of powerful countries came walking out of Sarvajna's face, with all of their appurtenance and jewels and expensive gilded offices and so on. Out of his eyes, Sudana saw as many hundreds of thousands of suns as atoms in countless Buddha fields, lighting up all the hells, dispersing the great darkness in the world, removing the darkness of sentient beings' delusions, relieving the beings in the frigid hells from the pains of cold and shining clear light in lands made of lotus fibers, and so on and so on and so on. Of course, he had a little circle of hair right up here between his eyes. From there, Sudana saw as many moons as atoms in the countless Buddha lands. From his forehead, he saw as many Brahmins, great gods, king of the gods, as atoms in countless Buddha fields. From his head, as many bodhisattvas as atoms in countless Buddha fields. And now, of course, the bodhisattvas, there's a lot of them. And it goes on for many pages about all the bodhisattvas that he sees emerging from Sarvajna's head. and I won't go into all the different bodhisattvas, but they seem to go along with the 10 paramitas. So there are bodhisattvas who are teaching giving, and bodhisattvas who are expressing morality, and so on, with all 10 paramitas, including the extra ones that we don't usually mention, like upaya, skillful means, vows, powers, and super knowledge. All of that is emerging from his head. And then there are showers of teaching rain down. And there's about 2 pages of different kinds of showers of teachings that rain down. Sudana stood before Sarvajna, watching all this emerge as he sat. For a day and a night, for 2 days and nights, 7 days and nights, a fortnight, a month, 6 months, and 6 more days and nights. After 6 months and 6 days and nights, the monk Sarvajna rose from his concentration. How vast, how measureless its scope, how inconceivable its arrays of projections, how incomparable its light, how innumerable its manifestations, how unsurpassable its range, how pure its sphere, how it illuminates everywhere equally, how it works for the benefit of infinite beings in that it is directed to the extinction of the measureless mass of suffering of all sentient beings, to extinguish the sufferings of the destitute, to end all hellish states, to rescue beings from brutish states, to close the door on all conditions inopportune for enlightenment. So Sudana asks him about his concentration, what's the name of it? And he says, manifestation of universal purification. That's the name of the concentration. And then he says the usual thing. He says, well, this might look like an impressive thing, and I'm very happy that I can practice this and share it with you. But there's still more. This is nothing compared to what you have. So go forth and visit the next teacher. And he does. So one more, okay? Can you stand it?
Yes.
One more. I think we can do it. This one is starts on page 93. Jayosh Mayatana. Jayosh Mayatana, who is a spiritual prince, a priest. And this one is rather extraordinary and unexpected, I think. So when Sudana encounters him, he was practicing an ascetic exercise of enduring fierce heat with his mind on omniscience. On 4 sides were huge bonfires like mountains ablaze. Rising above appeared a great mountain precipice, a razor edge path. And you know, there are I think that still exists. They actually do this. There are ascetic monks from Tendai, I think, who I think they actually do build bonfires. And they sit in the middle of 4 bonfires for some amazing, a week without sleeping or something like that. They do the amazing things, these guys. they like go on runs up and down the mountains, lasting days and days and days without eating food. I don't know why they do these things, but it's been going on a long time. And I guess probably they got it from here. Some people take these sutras quite literally. So anyway, this guy, this priest here, is sitting in the middle of these bonfires at the foot of a giant mountain precipice. Suddhodana goes up to him, pays his respects, and says, "Noble one, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings." And he says that to every teacher. That's what he always says. "I want to do this, but I have no idea how to do it. I don't know what I need to know, and I don't know how to do it. So please help me." So he says that. And then he says, "And I hear you know. They told me, the last teacher told me you know, so I'm asking." And the priest looks at him and says, "Climb this razor edge path mountain," which apparently was really, really high, "and jump off the mountain into the fire. And that's how you'll purify your enlightening practice." So, for the first time, Suddhodana has doubts. He doesn't know if this is such a good idea. And for the first time, it occurs to him, how do I know, just because the last guy told me, you know, that this guy is so smart, how do I know this guy really is on the up and up? How do I know he's not a demon, you know, trying to do exactly the wrong thing for me? How am I supposed to know whether or not to trust this guy? It's the first and maybe the only time that Suddhodana has that feeling. So, and it describes, you know, all of the things that Suddhodana thought at that time. And so he just didn't quite do this. He just sort of like sat there in a doubtful state for a minute. While he was involved in these thoughts, 10,000 Brahma gods appeared in the sky and said to him, "Don't think like that. This guy is okay, blah, blah." They go on and on and on. 10,000 Brahma gods. After they left, 10,000 demons stood up in the sky and they showered celestial jewels and they said, "The light emitted from the flames used by this priest in his heat mortification obscures our abodes, our ornaments, and our paraphernalia. We are terrified to go to him who teaches in such a way that coming to ourselves and getting back to our right minds, we aspire to enlightenment and become irreversible on the way to supreme perfect enlightenment." So the demons are vouching for him because they kind of got knocked out of their demonness by the heat, and now they also are aspiring to enlightenment. Then came 10,000 gods of pleasant emanation, same kind of thing. 10,000 more gods of the heaven of timely portion. Who knew there were these heavens, but there are. 100,000 celestial beings. That's right, 100,000 celestial beings of the 33-fold heavens, each with 32 siblings. 32 siblings and sons and daughters showered rain from the clouds and again vouched for this priest. Also, 10,000 rain spirits showered rain from the clouds, also vouching for this priest. After that, 10,000 spirit chiefs standing in the middle of the sky, same thing, followed by 10,000 chief celestial musicians playing gorgeous music, all of which was to say, "This guy is okay, you should listen to him." 10,000 titan kings, 10,000 bird kings, 10,000 centaur kings, innumerable gods of the realms of desire. So there were a lot of people vouching for this guy. So Sudana was now enraptured, transported, overjoyed, happy, having heard all this. And he now, his doubts were dispelled, he now considered the priest Jayoshmata Ayatana to be a true spiritual benefactor. And he bowed before him and said, "I confess my error in not recognizing you." And then he climbed the path up the cliff of the mountain, a massive razor edge, and threw himself off into the fire. And as he was falling, he attained an enlightening concentration called well-established. I'll bet. On contact with the fire, he attained an enlightening concentration called mystic knowledge of the bliss of tranquility. And he said, "How wonderful is the pleasant feeling of this fire and this razor edge mountain." So that's a good story. And I actually think that it is a story to be seriously contemplated and taken quite seriously. We are supposed to follow and honor teachers, but how can we trust them? Right? How do we know whether they're trustworthy? Now, it's not that hard to trust them if they're nice and good and supportive people who follow precepts, as do most of the teachers that we know. People who behave as you would expect a spiritual teacher to behave, it's not that hard to trust them. But what if they ask you to do something that seems dangerous or ill-advised, as in this outrageous story? Then, how do you know whether you can trust them? Actually, I hope that all our teachers are asking us to do something very dangerous and ill-advised. I think they are asking us. They are asking us, if they're serious about the Dharma, to give up self-clinging and be completely selfless, compassionate, and devoted to the Dharma, which from an ordinary, everyday point of view is something that is outrageously dangerous and not to be done, because, you know, we would like to live our lives and have some fun and do this and that. So from an ordinary point of view, actually, practice is very dangerous. Though from a practice point of view, there is nothing more dangerous than ordinary life. If you understand what I mean. So this story, while it seems outrageous, is actually pretty relevant, I think, for us. How can we trust our teachers? How can we trust the Dharma if it is asking us to give up our most cherished possession, our self-clinging? I think most of us come to the Dharma because we want to find real peace, real truth. And then it turns out that in order to do that, we have to go beyond what we already know, what we already are, which can be sometimes very uncomfortable. I mean, if the Dharma doesn't challenge our fundamentally held point of view that we come with, then what's the point? Why bother? You know, do something else. You can keep your point of view going to the movies. Why keep your point of view coming to the Dharma? The Dharma transforms us because it challenges us in that fundamental way. So how does, analyze this, you know, how does Sudhana deal with this question? Well, the first thing is, he doubts, as he should. Who wouldn't, right? He doubts. And he doesn't pretend he doesn't. You know, people who doubt often talk themselves out of their own doubt, and it's really a bad thing. He doubts, and he knows that he doubts, and he says so. But then, he waits. He doesn't just run away. He doesn't act on his doubts right away, even though he knows they're there. He observes them. And then, of course, the countless kinds of beings show up to reassure him that he need not doubt. And the number of beings listed there is an index of how strong his doubt must have been. It took that many beings to overcome it. But eventually, his doubts are dispelled, and he is able to follow out the instructions, crazy as they seem at first. And of course, it's fine. It's not as it appeared to him. So that might be something that happens to us. Maybe, maybe not. And I think, you know, we should reserve the right to doubt our teachers. I don't think that this injunction to go beyond ourselves, which I do think we have to do, I don't think it means that we're supposed to follow somebody else. Going beyond ourselves doesn't necessarily mean follow somebody else's idea. Give up your doubts. Forget about it. Just listen to me. Notice that Jayaushmatayana never says that to Sudhana. He doesn't say that. He doesn't try to talk him into it. He just gives the instruction, and the rest is up to Sudhana. I think that the spiritual practice of challenging your will in order to break your will, like they used to do in the 1960s in counter groups, is not a great spiritual practice. I think it's not even a spiritual practice, in my opinion. Trust is so important in the Dharma. And trust is an intimate personal matter. Trust is something you come to on your own, at your own pace, in your own way. And if trust seems like it's being forced on you by others, whether that other be a person or a group, because sometimes a group enforces that, then it's not trustworthy. That's what I wanted to tell you today. Thank you for listening. I would be very surprised if everybody in this room could not tell each other about two or three really profound spiritual teachers in their lives that they encountered before the age of 10 years old. I would be surprised. So let's do that. Let's get into groups and talk about people who have been important spiritual teachers in our lives. It doesn't have to be before you were 10. It could be any time in your life. But teachers who, people who really influenced your spiritual development and who you'll never forget. I know I have many, many people like that that I cherish always. So get in groups of three, and we'll do the same online, and just bring up just a little sketch of who that person or two is.